Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. It's late August, and that means back to school time is around the corner. Usually when we talk about school, it's elementary school or high school or even graduation, but we wanted to take a little time over the next few days to talk about education for the littlest students in pre-kindergarten. Across the country, about 1.5 million four-year-olds are enrolled in some form of publicly funded early education. That's according to the Department of Education. Those numbers have been increasing steadily in recent years. Still, millions of children have no real access to pre-K or early childhood education at all. Who gets access and what the quality of that access is can all depend on the state and the city where you live. Later this week, we'll be looking at the science behind early education, but today we wanted to look at the basic question of who has access to pre-K and who doesn't.
About 40% of four-year-olds currently participate in some type of publicly funded pre-K program.
Abby Lieberman is a policy analyst on the Early and Elementary Education Policy Team at New America, and she says that access to early childhood education is growing, but still spotty.
The vast majority of these children are in a state-funded program. Last year, state-funded programs served about 1.5 million children, which is higher than ever before. So enrollment in these programs has been increasing slowly but steadily over the last decade or so. But progress has been really uneven. So whether a four-year-old attends a public pre-K program largely depends on the state or even the city that he or she lives in. States like Florida, Oklahoma, D.C., and Wisconsin all lead the way in access, serving more than 70% of four-year-olds. But like you mentioned, a handful of other states haven't started pre-K programs at all. In those states, Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, there is no state option for pre-K. And then some local governments have also stepped up and expanded access instead of waiting for the state to do so. So in cities like San Antonio, Philadelphia, of course, New York City's program is talked about and analyzed all the time. There are examples of cities that have really made early learning a priority.
You say public access to pre-K. Does that mean that in these jurisdictions, these states or cities that you're talking about, it's basically public school, just like first grade, third grade, fifth grade?
Sure. So that's one way to look at it. When we say publicly funded pre-K, it doesn't necessarily mean, though, that it's in an elementary school. It can be an elementary school. They can also receive public funding in a center-based program. Depending on the state or district, this will vary where they are serving students in pre-K. And no setting is inherently better than another. It depends on what works for parents, for children, and what the state and local government decides to do.
The Obama administration had a push relatively early in the administration for what they called universal pre-K. The idea here being federally funded pre-K so that every school district, I imagine, across America could have it. Whatever happened with that proposal, did it gain enough support in Congress that it could be something that could happen in the future?
So the Obama administration did make funding for early learning a really high priority, and especially for pre-K. So they did this through mostly competitive grant programs that were encouraging states to invest more and build out their programs. The Trump administration has not expressed much interest in pre-K and has not proposed any increases in funding in this area. But the federal government still does play a role in pre-K, mainly through the Head Start program, which gets about $9 billion each year. The Head Start program serves many of the country's lowest income families, and it's been around for more than 50 years and has bipartisan support in Congress.
So I asked the question about federal investment because on the state level, you know, states have budgets that are strapped and nobody wants to cut high schools. So it seems like in states that have confrontations with budget deficits or budget problems, that pre-K is often the first thing to get cut.
Yes, oftentimes pre-K is subject to cuts when budgets are tight. We saw this during the recession when many states spent less on pre-K. This is for a few reasons. Pre-K is new. It's also optional in all states, and it's already part-time in many states. So it's easier to cut slots when children aren't required to attend. It's also because of the way that pre-K is often funded. So according to the Education Commission of the states, only 9 states in D.C. include pre-K programs in their state education funding formulas. Other states are funding pre-K maybe through a lottery or a sales tax, like a soda tax. But when it's included in the state funding formula, it signifies that pre-K is part of the public education system and might make it more difficult to cut because the funding is sustained over time. It's not an annual decision. For these reasons, it's unfortunate that pre-K is often subject to cuts.
So if only 9 states include it in the formula, meaning it's an official part of public education, that means it sort of hangs out on a budget limb in other states and jurisdictions, right? I mean, how far along are state and local politicians along this path of starting to think of universal pre-K as part of education, just like fifth grade?
It varies all across the board. And in terms of universal programs, some states are choosing to expand access, make it universal. But when funding is limited, others are choosing to target certain groups of kids, such as low-income families, those with special needs, dual language learners, and the kids that can really stand to benefit the most. So states are making tough decisions, whether it's fund more with less money, fund less with more money, and how to get those funds.
So, Abby Lieberman, you mentioned that 40% of children nationwide have access to publicly funded pre-K. What about the other 60%? Their parents can pay cash for it, I guess, on the private pre-K market. What are those kids doing?
So the rest of the kids, like you said, might be in private pre-K programs where their parents are paying out of pocket. This can be prohibitively expensive. We often hear the statistic that child care is more expensive than public college tuition in some states. And pre-K is also coming at a time when, you know, parents often don't have the savings. They can't afford these programs. So other parents might be reliant on federal subsidies. Other parents might choose to stay home with their children. Of course, this is becoming less common as more households have all parents working outside the home. Also, family, friend, and neighbor care. So, you know, children staying with neighbors, with grandparents is also very common throughout the U.S.
Let me get you into the prediction business. Do you expect more states and jurisdictions to expand pre-K in their jurisdictions? Where does this go?
So I'm reluctant to make predictions, but I think, you know, pre-K access has been expanding over the last decade or so, and I don't see this changing. Pre-K is one of the few areas where there is bipartisan support, and I think that really reflects a shift in the national attitude towards the value of early education. So state and local governments are stepping up and they're expanding access and responding to the needs of their constituents. The research is there, and how to fund it is really, really the obstacle that a lot of policymakers are dealing with.
Abby Lieberman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Abby Lieberman is policy analyst on the Early and Elementary Education Policy Team at New America.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.